Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In the mid-2000s, Western nations, led by the United States, began drafting environmental laws that encouraged the use of vegetable oil and fuels. But this ambitious move to reduce carbon dioxide emissions and curb global warming had unforeseen consequences. Warnings that the policies could have the opposite of their intended effect went unheeded. Instead, this mandate has led to industrial-scale deforestation and a huge spike in carbon emissions. Today, we talk with ProPublica writer Abram Lustgarten about the environmental and climate calamities the biofuels mandate has wrought. Abram is a senior environmental reporter at ProPublica. His recent article, "Palm Oil Was Supposed to Help Save the Planet, Instead It Unleashed a Catastrophe," was published in the New York Times Magazine on November 20th, 2018. Abram, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
I've talked about palm oil as a problem on the show a number of times. I've never seen the connection made so starkly as you made in your article about the problems that palm oil plantations create, not just in terms of destroying habitat in Indonesia and other tropical rainforests, but their connection to increasing climate change. The thing that really was interesting to me was that you show the connection between the biofuels mandate and how that has actually increased palm oil production. So I wanted to talk about how you came across this connection in the first place.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was kind of working on two separate stories at the outset. I was looking at environmental concerns around palm oil, grown largely in Indonesia and Malaysia, and its climate implications, because increasingly palm oil there is being grown in what was formerly forest habitat, but existing on what's called peatland, which is almost like a boggy soil, and it contains an enormous amount of carbon. It's similar to permafrost in the Arctic, and peatland exists around the world, but is very prevalent in Southeast Asian rainforests. And so, what was happening to grow the palm oil is that not only were the forests, which themselves are an enormous carbon sink, were being cut down to grow palm plantations, but then the forests were on these peatland bogs, and to grow the palm oil, you have to then drain and dry out the bogs, and that itself releases another huge load of carbon dioxide into the air. So I was examining palm oil's implications for the climate on one hand. On the other hand, really unrelated in my mind, I'd been examining the renewable fuel standard that the United States has, and that is a law, passed in most recently in 2007, the latest iteration in 2007, which requires that a certain amount of various kinds of biofuels are mixed in with standard petroleum-based diesel and gasoline, and there's a whole trading system and credits and so forth. And I was suspicious about the potential corruption in that system. What I hadn't realized at the outset, but learned through reporting down both of these avenues, is that, as you mentioned, they're quite connected. That the renewable fuel standard drives a lot of different kinds of fuel use, like ethanol, but it also supports the use of biodiesel. And that biodiesel, indirectly, in a little bit of a convoluted way, but had resulted in even more deforestation and more push to grow more palm oil in Indonesia. And so my stories became one at that point, and began looking at how U.S. fuels policy was supporting the deforestation in Indonesia.
Well, before we get into the deforestation in Indonesia, let's talk a little bit about the biofuel mandate and who's been pushing that. It was kind of interesting. I remember when Obama was running for president, he was really a big supporter of corn ethanol, being from Illinois. And it showed to me at that time there's a lot of contradictions between people who are progressive Democrats, or at least present themselves that way, and their ties to big industry, whether it's the biofuels industry or agribusiness or petrochemicals, that there are these strange little interconnections that happen.
Sure. Yeah, it's a complicated, sort of murky political area in U.S. politics. I mean, the renewable fuel standard goes back to the early 2000s. It was something that came into form around 2002, 2003. First was passed into law in the Bush administration in 2005, and then was revised in 2007 in the version that I was looking at. And it mandated that U.S. oil and gas refiners use a certain amount of quote unquote renewable renewable fuel. And there were multiple goals behind this legislation. Some were political, some were financial, as they always are, and some were notably to help the environment, help the planet, and also to make the United States a little more energy independent, to reduce our reliance on foreign oil imports. So this was before, you know, the fracking boom and before U.S. oil drilling expanded as much as it has today. So that oil independence was really important as well. Democrats in particular, you know, they have it's a double-edged sword for them. When Democrats were in power, as they were at the time, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, and Democrats held the majority in Congress, they hold that majority with the support of, you know, more moderate farm belt and agricultural states across the Midwest. And those states have, not only do Democrats, of course, you know, have a platform around climate change, but those states have a very, very strong financial interest in the health of their agriculture industries. They're susceptible to lobbying from that industry, which includes, you know, not only the big, big farm, industry organizations, but companies like Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill and Monsanto and companies like that. And all of those companies stand to benefit from the idea of biofuels, which, you know, if you want to separate from palm oil for a minute, is mostly ethanol. Corn ethanol. So expanded the production, the growing of corn crops across the Midwest, mostly to be refined into an alcohol, which is mixed in, blended in with gasoline to various degrees, and was also supposed to, you know, help the planet. Turns out to be far, far worse than just burning gasoline.
So whose idea was this in the first place?
It's hard to pin the exact origin of it, but as close as I could get, it's somewhere between the farmers and farm industry itself and the representatives of those farm states. So you see early legislation, early draft coming from, you know, representatives from Indiana and Missouri and Nebraska and places like that. In the case of biodiesel, which I focused on, which is a smaller component than ethanol, but you had a soybean industry that was looking at a byproduct of, you know, so when you grow soybeans, you get the meal, which is used for food, and you get a leftover oil, and the oil is about 20% of the product. And you had a soybean industry that was looking for something to do with its soybean oil and began lobbying to use it as a biofuel. They actually went, opened an office in Washington, D.C., hired one of the most prominent lobbying firms in Washington, and started pushing for the creation of policies that would buy that leftover oil and use it for fuel.
So it wasn't really coming from a science base, it seems. And it also seems like it wasn't generated first by politicians, but more it was generated by the industry itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, not only was it not coming from a science-based origin, but, as I went through with experts, for how the legislation unfolded, it seems that there was so little even thought or consideration given to the science of biofuels at the time the legislation was passed. It's really kind of astounding. And in retrospect, you know, there were, my impression is that the legislators who debated and wrote these issues into bills and ultimately passed those bills really, were held to their preconceptions of what they thought biofuels or green energy or vegetable-based fuels might be, and really kind of like a cognitive bias that anything that comes from plants must be better for the environment as far as that part of the conversation goes. So really just sort of an assumption and never any real thorough examination of, you know, whether that assumption is true or much consideration until the very last minute of, you know, what came to be called a life cycle analysis, a real, you know, investigation of the carbon content of various fuel sources.
Well, as a consumer, I discovered the problems with ethanol pretty early on when the first mandate came in, and I don't remember how much it was. I think now it's up to 15% in gasoline, but I think even before it was that much, and it used to also just be in the winter, and then they started adding it in the summer. I noticed that my mileage dropped considerably, and so I'm thinking, how is this decreasing carbon emissions or decreasing other kinds of pollutants in the atmosphere created by my car when I'm having to use more gas to get the same distance? And it didn't, and that was something that I think came up as a concern. A lot of people were arguing that ethanol was really reducing mileage. But was that being heard, or was that just kind of run over?
Well, my expertise is not in ethanol as much as biodiesel, but I've heard that concern, and I think that and other concerns, you know, they emerged pretty quickly after the laws were passed, 2005, 2007. It didn't take long for, you know, the fallacies of this program to become apparent, including the concerns that it wasn't going to be better for the climate. But it also didn't take long for the benefits to the agriculture industry and to the, you know, the voting groups that supported the legislation to be very apparent, and for them to become quite used to it, to, you know, enormous subsidies, enormous amounts of money pumped into the agriculture industry. And as soon as that happened, it's very hard to take that kind of benefit away. So as quickly as the problems became known, it also just became a kind of intractable topic in Washington, and it still is today.
Well, as far as biofuels go, I know that there was a big push a number of years ago. People were like making recycling vegetable oil, basically, and salad oil and cooking oils. And you could go fill up your car if you had a diesel engine. You could fill up your car with these vegetable oils. But my understanding is that actually vegetable oil pollution is not that much better than from petroleum-based diesel.
So that's true, but this is also where biofuels gets complicated. To try to like very very simply explain, you know, the life cycle emissions analysis, you try to associate carbon with every step in the life cycle production of a substance, of a plant. And so, you know, if you have a tree that grows naturally in an environment, that tree absorbs a certain amount of carbon. You cut that tree down to make space for a crop, and it releases that amount of carbon, and then the new crop absorbs a certain amount, and there's carbon associated with farming it and running the tractor and using the fertilizer and all of that. And so that all gets counted towards, you know, calculating how much carbon is associated with a fuel that burns in the end. And like you mentioned, you know, using recycled, French fry oil does emit just as much pollution as burning gasoline, or very close, or burning oil. So there's not much benefit there. But what you're trying to figure out is whether there's a greater benefit, less carbon used on the front end of the equation. And it turns out that recycling fuels like that is actually a great benefit to the environment, because that fuel, that French fry oil already served a different purpose. And so, you know, the carbon burden or responsibility that oil has already gone to the benefit of making French fries, which also has a carbon footprint. And so by the time it's used for fuel, you're basically having cutting in half a footprint that already exists. Whereas burning, you know, oil straight out of the ground, there is no, there's no recycling. There's no double use of that fuel. It came from, you know, fossilized carbon that had been locked, you know, deep in the earth for millennia. And what we looked at with, you know, ethanol, biodiesel is somewhere in between. When you don't recycle a fuel, then, you have a one-time use, and you have to compare that one-time use carbon cycle, to oil and gas. But the greatest benefit of biofuels is either in advanced biofuels, switchgrasses and things like that, or in recycled fuels like you just described.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with ProPublica writer Abram Lustgarten about the environmental and climate calamities the biofuels mandate has wrought. Now, I want to sort of start to segue into what's been going on in Indonesia in a very intense way for the last decade and more. But you mentioned briefly just a little while ago about life cycle analysis. So let's talk about what that really means in terms of understanding just how much of a carbon footprint biofuels would have and where that carbon footprint is basically enhanced by.
Yeah, so on a simple one-to-one, comparison, you take the life cycle of petroleum fuel and you compare it to the life cycle of a plant-based fuel, let's say, biodiesel. And so you compare the amount of carbon that's associated with pulling oil out of the ground, shipping it around the world, refining it in a refinery, and shipping it to in its end product to a gas station. You don't necessarily count the amount of emissions that come out of the tailpipe when that fuel is used, because the assumption when you do a biofuels analysis is that a certain amount of carbon was sequestered by growing the plants in the first place, and that cancels out the emissions at the end of the cycle. So on the plant side of that life cycle analysis, you count the benefit from planting the plant, the carbon associated with growing that plant, harvesting it, fertilizing it, converting it to fuel, which is a refining process, also shipping it around the world, blending it into gasoline, and then the tailpipe, you know, to the end of the process. And you just look at these two, it's like a balance sheet for a bank account, and you compare, you know, what appears to be a benefit, or is not a benefit. At that simple comparison level, most biofuels look, to be hugely beneficial compared to oil and gas. What my reporting focused on was, a corner of the research community, a now Princeton researcher named Timothy Searchinger, who had written a bunch of papers on what he called indirect land use change. And that was the idea that the kind of balance sheet analysis that I just described only works if you start from a very, neutral starting point, which is basically like unused, fertile but underutilized land, where there's no nothing lost and no compromise to using that land to grow biofuels. And his hypothesis, which looks largely to be correct, is that land like that doesn't really exist. And so that anytime you want to buy to grow a biofuel, to grow more corn in the Midwest or more palm, it has to come at the expense of something else that was already growing on that land. And that was basically a line item in the balance sheet that hadn't been counted before. And so if you look at what is previously growing on that land before biofuels were grown, in the case of Indonesia, it's rainforest. In the case of ethanol in the Midwest, it might have been corn that was used for food or used for a different purpose. But you have to subtract the carbon benefit of what's lost before you start at ground zero in your calculation of the life cycle analysis. And when you do that for palm oil, what's lost, the carbon content of the rainforest in particular, is so enormous that it completely upsets the entire conversation. Without considering land use change, it looks to be quite beneficial. As soon as you consider land use change, it looks to be horribly worse for the climate than just burning regular oil.
Well, let's make the connection now between a lot of why that palm oil is being grown now in Indonesia and the conversion of cropland in the United States from growing corn and soybeans for food or for feedstock food to turning it into biofuels.
Yeah, so Indonesia is Indonesia and Malaysia together supply about 90% of the world's palm oil supply, and palm oil has become very much a ubiquitous substance for lots of things well beyond fuel. Should say that fuel is actually a fairly small proportion of what palm oil is used for globally. It's used in soaps and shampoos and in ice cream as a bonding agent and in cereals, and it's very prevalent. It's in all sorts of foods. It's in everybody's pantry and cupboards, and when we all use it on a daily basis, it has found its way into most food products that we use, and fuels are a relatively small part of that use. But the palm oil industry grew in Indonesia quite deliberately. They saw the opportunity to use their land to grow a crop. They saw palm oil as an easy crop to grow there, and they saw enormous business potential, economic potential in expanding that industry. And so they pushed the idea, even in Asia as a food source, that oil, cooking oils in general, should be palm oil and not coconut oil and not olive oil and not other, seed oils. So they built an industry over many, many years. And they similarly saw an opportunity for that industry to be expanded further by pushing the idea of biofuels globally to both Europe and to the United States. And so when you see the United States begin to debate legislation around mandating biofuels in the early 2000s, you see that the Indonesian government in particular and the Malaysian government as well were active in lobbying for this to happen. Their big companies were active in the United States in pushing for those issues. The governments themselves hosted U.S. regulators, U.S. Legislators to come to Indonesia to see the potential to tour palm forests and so forth. The Indonesian palm industry saw an opportunity in both the U.S. and Europe developing biofuels mandates, and it pushed for that, for those pieces of legislation and regulations, and it lobbied for them. It was very active, and at the same time at home, it planned for a really dramatic and massive expansion of its palm oil industry, preparing to meet that increased demand from the United States and Europe.
So let's talk about what kind of impact that's had on the ecosystems throughout the rainforests in Indonesia and Malaysia.
So I spent time in Indonesia reporting on the island of Borneo. The northern part of Borneo is Malaysia. The bulk of the island and the southern, four-fifths is Indonesia in the states of East, Central, and West Kalimantan. And it's raw rainforest, and it's some of the most, primitive tropical rainforest left in the world today. And it is largely being overrun, just as many other Indonesian islands already have, with palm plantations. And, these plantations are industrialized agriculture. They take a wild rainforest type of terrain and mow it down to the ground and install a grid of canal waterways and dirt roads in a perfect square pattern that stretch over many tens of miles, and then they plant little small oil palm trees, which look very similar to the kind of palm tree that that we are all familiar with seeing on postcards from Florida. And these trees take about, 6 to 7 years to mature to produce oil palm, and then they last about 25 years, and they all grow to about the same height, these forests are in sort of unnatural rows where you can look down a row of trees and see, all the way to the vanishing point. It just sort of never ends. It's a very predictable and controlled looking landscape. And that's what has replaced and is replacing rainforest across much of the island of Borneo as the palm plantations are continuously expanded.
Well, as you describe in your article, what is most alarming is the disconnect between what's supposed to be going on in Indonesia in terms of protecting national forests and basically protecting remaining peatland habitat and what's actually going on.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as you mentioned at the outset, palm oil has a number of environmental problems, and these problems are not new. Palm oil has been controversial for many, many years because it threatens the orangutan habitat. It threatens all sorts of forest habitat. What hadn't been discussed a whole lot, I found before my reporting, is its carbon problem. So looking at palm oil production and palm plantations in terms of climate change, and it turns out, as I mentioned, the peatland habitat that the palm is grown, that much of the palm is being grown on, is enormously bad for the climate. So that was fairly new, most interesting to me is that the fuels policies coming from the U.S. and Europe are aimed squarely at having the opposite effect, so are aimed at helping climate change, and it turns out that they're making it worse. But the Indonesian government, as a proponent of its industry, this is a huge part of Indonesia's economy, has long looked at these environmental risks and its environmental reputation as a problem to be solved, and it has taken, going back more than a decade, many steps to try to green the industry and also to give the industry the appearance of being much greener than it is. And it's implemented along the way. Its companies and industries have signed on to international agreements, groups for sustainable palm oil, certification programs that Western companies want their suppliers to abide by in order to use that supply. The government itself has outlawed the cutting of new forest. It has outlawed the production of palm oil on these sensitive peatlands. It has claimed to make all of these, controls to improve the environmental situation around palm oil in Indonesia. And what I found when I went there is that despite all of these promises and assurances, that really very little of that had any practical effect. That where logging and cutting of rainforest was supposed to be illegal, it was still happening. That where people promised me there was no development on peatland, there was development on peatland that I observed in my visit. And that the industry itself, largely saw these environmental promises as a propaganda effort to give Western buyers an excuse to continue buying their product.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with ProPublica Abram Lustgarten about the environmental and climate calamities brought on by the biofuels mandate here in the United States and the European Union. Well, beyond... Actually, what I was thinking about as you were talking about the disconnect between what the government says and what they actually do, I was watching a documentary last night about DuPont and the whole Teflon debacle, and basically how the EPA had rules that were written by DuPont executives to basically deny that there was any danger to C8, the main ingredient in Teflon. And while I was watching it last night, I was thinking, this feels like the government of Indonesia. And I'm wondering if you see there's some similarities in the ways that government regulations are actually controlled by industries that have a greater interest in their bottom line than in the human good.
There's certainly some similarities and parallels. I can't pretend to understand, the internal workings of Indonesia's regulatory system well enough to say. My impression is that certainly the U.S., and I've done a lot of other reporting on the EPA and its toxicology program and chemical regulation program, and it's true that it's been enormously influenced by industry. But my impression is that Indonesia is different because I think that the whole story starts with industry. The regulation is really sort of secondary and superficial, whereas, in the United States, the regulations existed and the industry has stepped in to try to affect them and water them down. I don't think that much in terms of regulation or oversight of the forestry industry happens in Indonesia, without the industry being involved from the very outset and strategizing with the government, how to go forward and preserve the importance that those industries have for Indonesia's economy.
So besides it being really bad for the environment, it also seems like this industry is very bad for the lives of a lot of environmentalists and journalists. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the dangers that environmentalists who are fighting the palm oil industry are facing.
Yeah, so Indonesia's largest industries are resource industries, and palm oil is one of them, along with coal and along with timber. And, all of these make the industries that run, those plantations and those operations enormously powerful. They operate in extremely rural places. Indonesia has enormous cities, but the resource extraction industries happen in places like Borneo, or Papua, and these are, far less developed areas with indigenous communities and, smaller cities and villages, dotted throughout. And many, many people are routinely displaced and have been historically and still are today by the expansion of these industries. And they don't have much power or ability or political clout to do anything about it. And the only people that really come to their rescue are, a handful of Indonesian-based non-government organizations, environmental groups, some of which are supported by, the big international environmental groups like Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth. But these activists are quite involved and relatively, you know, influential in Indonesian politics and in pushing these controversies, you know, at least to the forefront of conversation in Indonesia. And I heard a lot of stories about reprisals towards the environmentalists I worked with, you know, in particular. One of the men that I spent a lot of time with, you know, had described numerous death threats, fleeing his office, disappearing for a week at a time because he thought he was about to be killed. Global Witness, you know, cites the murders of, you know, about eight at the last time I counted, environmental activists who had been killed in Indonesia for their actions around the palm oil industry. And my story focused on, you know, one whistleblower in the state of Kalimantan who had used to work for a palm industry and then came out with a story about. You know, how he believes his village and community had essentially been swindled out of their land by the palm company that he worked for, and he had the documents to prove it, which I reviewed. But shortly after his you know, his going public with this information, he was arrested on trumped up charges of embezzlement for the company. And, you know, he claimed his innocence, and ultimately a court found that there was absolutely no evidence to, you know, to hold him, and he was released. But he'd been, you know, intimidated for a year and a half through that process and arrested and imprisoned for 8 months. And those kind of tactics, I think, are very, very common. You know, so it's the industry that has the political influence. It's the industry that has the local power and often, you know, some degree of control over local governments, and the industry that tries to tamp down, you know, any kind of, you know, of obstruction or vocal concern from residents or activists. Or even, you know, to the extent that they can, the international media.
So what kind of connection is there between the on-the-ground companies that are doing the planting and the cultivation of the palm oil plantations and international companies and perhaps American companies that are distributing the palm oil?
Well, it's all interconnected. The big Indonesian palm oil companies tend to, a lot of the palm oil in Indonesia is eventually funneled through distribution through some of the largest Indonesian companies. So companies like one called Wilmar, another called Sinar Mas, another called Salim Group. And these are huge global conglomerates that have many businesses in addition to palm oil, but are extremely powerful palm oil distributors. And each of those companies then distribute on the international market. So they distribute to companies like Nestle or Pepsi for use in foods. And in Europe, they distribute directly to the fuel refiners and manufacturers. We'll get to it, but palm oil isn't used directly in biodiesel in the United States, but the Indonesian companies distribute, you know, where biodiesel is used directly from palm oil, they distribute directly into those markets in Germany and in Sweden and in France. So they are quite connected. And one of the big efforts that have been made to make the Indonesian industry more sustainable is an agreement called the RSPO for Sustainable Palm Oil. And the Western companies like Pepsi or Nestle, have used the RSPO as a way to, they try to trace their supply chains, and they try to ensure their customers that when you buy, you know, ice cream, Ben & Jerry's ice cream in the United States that contains palm oil, that at least they can say that palm oil has been sustainably sourced, that they've tracked it back because, say, Wilmar is a member of this organization, and Wilmar has pledged to only grow palm oil in sustainable ways and not in the most carbon damaging ways. And so they try to, the Western companies use those certifications and work with the Indonesian companies to try to assure that their palm oil is sustainably sourced. It turns out that that's in some cases, I think, disingenuous. And then in the best case, it's at least very difficult to actually trace all the way back to its source, because that supply chain gets very muddled and very shadowy very quickly.
Well, is there any way to grow palm oil sustainably?
Yes, you can. As a crop, just looked at, scientifically, if you're grown on you know, non-rainforested land, palm oil is a pretty efficient source of both fuel oil and, you know, and a cooking oil. It's a prolific crop that grows, quite efficient fruiting. It produces a ton of oil for a very small, you know, amount of acreage, and it's pretty inexpensive to run. There's a lot of potential benefits to palm oil. And if you grow palm oil on, let's say, savanna land or land where you didn't have to cut down a forest to grow it, it could be a net benefit. And certainly if you avoid growing it on peatland, which is that boggy soil that contains so much carbon, it could be a huge net benefit. And when the palm oil industry was smaller, you know, and it was native to Indonesia and Malaysia, it might have had a more sustainable footprint. I mean, a lot of palm was grown in a smaller fashion without taking such a heavy toll on the forests there and on other lands there, that there, you know, is some semblance of balance. I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that palm is better than other types of vegetable oils, and if it's grown in a way that's less disruptive to the environment, that can be the case. But what happened is that the industry grew so fast and got so big that there was no land left to continue expanding unless you started slashing down the forest. And it's when you cut down rainforests and grow on peatland soil that palm oil becomes, at least from a carbon standpoint, becomes so disastrous.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about that process of cutting down the forest, because we didn't get into one salient point, which is that they burn the stumps and they burn the slag after they cut down the trees. And that's created some real serious problems, particularly when you are cutting down a rainforest that's on peat.
Yeah, I mean, the most extreme circumstances and the circumstances that I was most interested in my reporting, is where forests on peatland are cut down. And so, you know, one of the places we visited is on the southern end of the island of Borneo. And it's a low land. It's just a couple feet above sea level. And the peatland boggy soil is, it's waterlogged. It's like a marsh. And it's anaerobic soil, has very little oxygen. And so the organic matter that is in that soil doesn't break down the same way it does in our front yards, exposed to sunlight and air. Because it has a rainforest with a very large amount of organic matter above it, that rainforest is constantly shedding leaves and trees and branches and dead animals and bugs and all of that organic matter. And it just settles, into that bog, and it falls under the water table, which is very high, which is virtually at the surface. And without access to oxygen, it just compresses and it becomes this incredibly carbon-rich soil. And scientists I talked to said that this is essentially what coal is, or what oil and gas is a couple million years later, but it's in its infant form. And so you have these enormous trees that by themselves are a huge part of the planet's carbon cycle ecosystem, and it's growing. Those trees are growing on this boggy soil. And when a palm industry comes in, what they do is they cut a path through that boggy soil, and because the water table is so high, they take an excavator into the forest and they pull down the trees and they dig a canal through the bog, and the bog immediately fills with water because the water table is so high, and they use that water-filled canal then to float in more heavy equipment so they can essentially spread their equipment into the forest quickly, and then they tear down all of the trees until you have this, just this desiccated landscape of tree stumps and branches and debris on this boggy, wet soil area. And then they allow the canals to drain, and the water table essentially lowers over a little bit of time, and they sometimes pump it or they install gates that help the water flow only in one direction. And as the soil dries out, the land becomes firmer, so you can walk on it and plant on it, and so that it will eventually sustain planting palm trees, which have a root system and need a firm soil to grow in. But that peatland soil, it dries out, and after it dries out, the quickest way to clear these fields and prepare them for planting, and the cheapest way, is to light them on fire and burn those stumps and burn all of the trees, and the debris that's left that's not removed for timber, for example, from the surface. But the dried out peatland soil also turns out to be very flammable. It has a lot of organic matter, and as you know, as that organic matter in the soil itself dries out, it can burn. And the fires that are lit on the surface not only have, you know, their own sort of pollution component, but they begin to burn underground, and the peatland soils can burn for years at a time underground. Even when it appears that there's no fire on the earth, it can continue burning in an interconnected fashion underneath the ground. And when that carbon-rich peatland soil burns, it releases, I describe in the story, as a sort of a carbon bomb. It releases an almost indescribable, unfathomable amount of carbon directly into the atmosphere as an emissions byproduct of that fire. And the fires get out of control, so it's very difficult to stop it or control it. And the emissions from it are so enormous that there's an annual fire season, a wildfire season in Indonesia, much like we're experiencing here in the Western United States. In 2015 in Indonesia, that fire season got so out of control that it seemed like the entire country was burning, and much of the fire was on these sorts of peatlands and at least on palm oil plantations. And the smoke was considerable pollutant globally, so much that NASA scientists began to study it. And they found that the carbon emissions from those fires in Indonesia in 2015 summer season alone were the largest single release of carbon on the planet in 2,000 years. And that's the kind of scale of emissions that you get as a byproduct of tearing down these peatland forests to grow palm oil.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with ProPublica writer Abram Lustgarten about the dangers of mandating too much biofuel in our gasoline here in the United States and in the EU because of the consequences of what happens when you plant too many palm plantations in Indonesia, which is the source of some biofuels. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about another peatland area, which is also used for this in this case, fossil fuel extraction, and that's the peatlands in northern Alberta, and the boreal forest there. And a couple of years ago, I had an opportunity to fly over that boreal forest on my way to the tar sands operations in northern Alberta. And one of the things that really struck me was these seismic lines that go through the forest on a regular grid and are kind of a chilling reminder of just all the impacts that this kind of resource extraction has on the environment, stuff that you really can't see very well from the ground. In some ways, you see it a lot more from the air. But it also reminded me of these photos you have in your article of the palm plantations. And there's an analogy you draw between the palm plantations and oil derricks in Texas.
Yeah, and you know, I've seen those seismic lines, and also traveled up to Fort McMurray in Alberta. You know, and there is a similarity both in terms of the peatland, but also this scale of impact on the landscape, and that's what we were trying to describe in Indonesia. You know, this is a vast, vast area, and there is an industrialization of the landscape. I mean, agriculture in general, you know, whether you're in Nebraska or in Indonesia, is a sort of industrialization of the landscape on a large scale, as you describe. You know, if you stand you know, at the foot of a palm plantation, you don't necessarily get a sense of you know, the full might of that. You see a bunch of trees and it's shaded, and it could even look verdant, you know, to some people in some perspectives. But you get a little bit of a vantage point over that. And in Indonesia, it was from a hilltop, you know, a mountaintop, looking down over plantations so expansive we couldn't see the far end of it. If you're in an airplane in Alberta, it's, you know, you have the vantage point of, you know, of 10,000 feet in the air to see the same sort of thing. But what you see is, you know, that this methodical approach to resource extraction on forests, you know, happens, you know, in a very large scale, regularized, industrialized way. And, you know, it quickly gives you the impression that the environmental impact is far larger than you might have ever comprehended before having that vantage point.
Well, you also mentioned about this kid it was a kid in the plantation, and it reminded you of seeing a kid, like, let's say, in the landscape of Texas, surrounded by derricks, oil derricks. And I kind of like that analogy in a way of the palm plantations kind of being, in a way, like oil derricks are to the landscape.
Yeah, well, this is life now. You know, people don't leave these areas to grow palm in Indonesia. People don't move out of West Texas, to drill on their ranches or to have their ranches drilled. They live amongst it. That's existence in an area that's rich in natural resources and where natural resources are being extracted, and wanted to give that sense of analogy so that people who might have been familiar with what that's like here in the United States, in Texas or elsewhere, could have a sense of what it's like to be a child or a villager, still trying to grow food and find clean water and do your laundry and this industrialized agricultural landscape.
Well, I want to get back to something you said early on in the show, and it has to do with the potential corruption around the whole biofuel industry and the mandate and how it started. I mean, the corruption here in this country. And biofuels have been promoted as green renewable, part of our green renewable future. And it kind of reminds me in a way of the way that frack gas, what's called natural gas, is being promoted too, and with a lot of greenwashing going on. And I wonder what kinds of corruption potential corruption did you see when you were looking at how the biofuels operate, the biofuel industry operates, and how they're selling themselves?
Yeah. So to be clear, I mean, I did not come across in the biodiesel industry examples of explicit corruption. That wasn't one of the allegations that I made. But what I did see, is a pattern that fits other environmental issues as well, which is, that there is a scientific argument for all viewpoints. And the industry, tends to support scientific examination and the publication of scientific journals and studies which support their side of the argument. And in the United States, their side of the argument is that no matter how you compute the life cycle of a biofuel, biodiesel in this case, it's still better for the environment than burning petroleum diesel. So what I saw, there's a large body of research, and there's a great amount of disagreement over this subject in the United States. And the version of the life cycle analysis that I found after enormous amount of research that I trusted the most and based the article on is not without controversy. And there's a lot of people that disagree with that. And there's a lot of scientific studies that dispute that. Generally speaking, and this alone is not an indictment, but I found that those scientific studies that dispute the viewpoint that that I based a lot of my story on were often funded or almost always funded by agricultural interests, either the large agricultural universities or directly by the ag industries, its lobbying groups or its big companies. And those groups tended to the manipulation, if you want to call it that, happens in very, very subtle ways. It happens in terms of decision making about thousands of very seemingly inconsequential inputs that will be put into a computer model, and it's the end result of that computer model that will determine or make a determination about, the relative carbon benefit or lack of benefit of a biofuel. So there's a very subtle effort to tweak and manipulate the science to come out with the viewpoint that you want to achieve, which is not necessarily in itself, a form of corruption, but is at least a potential source for bias. And one of the things that we looked at is the Environmental Protection Agency's process. The EPA in the United States has to certify renewable fuel sources as being so significantly beneficial as to fall under this mandate program. Fuels have to qualify, basically. And the EPA did an exhaustive study of ethanol to at the start of the renewable fuels program of ethanol and biodiesel both. And it spent a couple of years on its first draft. And as far as I could tell, it put the bulk of its effort into its first draft. And that first draft really followed closely along the lines of the thinking of the scientists that I wrote my story about, with great concerns over the land use trade-offs and significant criticisms over the carbon footprint of these fuels, and ultimately concluded that ethanol and biodiesel, both from soy, were not going to be beneficial for the climate and might not qualify under the program. They received an enormous amount of feedback and pushback from the agricultural industry and from academic institutions that support the agricultural industry. And some of that pushback might have been quite scientifically valid, but some of it to me looked also, you know, quite conspicuously biased. And the net result was that very quickly, within the space of, you know, a small number of months, the EPA reversed course, issued a final draft that completely reversed its findings of its first draft, and found that not only, you know, were these sources of renewable fuels beneficial to the environment over gasoline, but by a large margin, that they easily qualified when that was just starkly different from what they'd found in their first draft findings. And so those were the kinds of, you know, abrupt changes in you know, in political sentiment and environmental or scientific perspective, you know, that raise big red flags for me.
Well, actually, it just kind of reminds me in a kind of chilling way of two issues that I've been dealing with. One was, again, going back to this movie I was watching last night about DuPont and Teflon, it was really chilling to watch these scientists that are on the payroll of DuPont basically denying that there was any health impacts or any dangers to having people have this compound C8 in their drinking water, and it turns out they were proven wrong in a lawsuit. But just watching the scientist after scientist say these things, and you're wondering how they can say that with a clean conscience, but I guess the paycheck is a lot bigger than their consciousness. And then the same thing with this debate that we're going on in this region around proposed frac gas facilities that want to be built, and the life cycle analyses that are being written for two projects here in the Northwest, where they're claiming that the methanol refinery in one case and an LNG facility in another case will in fact reduce carbon emissions. And the science that's used is very clearly prejudicial. It has major emissions. It uses very out-of-date facts. And yet this is the argument being made that, well, this is just one scientific view and the other scientific view is, you know, the one that the opponents have. So I'm wondering, how do we cut through this so that we can see this not as just a supposed battle of experts, but actually understanding that some of those experts are in the pay of the companies that they're trying to promote?
I don't have an easy solution for you on that one. I mean, from a public understanding perspective, you know, the best case is that people take the time to read a number of different perspectives and read some of the scientific studies and journals themselves, and can, you know, can make whatever distinctions they want to make. But that's, you know, as we know, less likely to happen, and you rely instead on, you know, on others to summarize it for you. You know, the second line of defense is to rely on, you know, our regulatory institutions, the EPA at the federal level or state environment and energy agencies at the state level, to, you know, to be those gatekeepers for us. Unfortunately, you know, as we're just describing, you know, that also doesn't always happen. It's an uphill battle where, you know, incremental change and incremental achievements, you know, can hopefully make a positive difference over time.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll both get back to work. Anyway, thanks a lot for joining us, Avram.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. And I keep me posted on your next article, because I find these things I really want to cover on the show. So thanks a lot.
I will.
And we've been talking today with ProPublica writer Avram Lustgarten, author of Palm Oil Was Supposed to Help Save the Planet, Instead It Unleashed a Catastrophe. And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Portland poet and activist Wendy Willis, author of These Are Strange Times, My Dear. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Natalie Merchant, and stay tuned for an entire rest of our day celebration of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Thanks for listening.
Where in hell can you go, far from the things that you know, far from the sprawl of concrete that keeps crawling its way, about 1,000 miles a day.